Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 164. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're going into the Mile High Club. I'm looking at two airplane disaster movies. The first one is from 1955 and is William Wellman's The High and the Mighty, starring John Wayne and a cast of fantastic character actors. Then we move on to 1970 for a movie that was phenomenally successful. It generated three sequels and a whole genre in a sense. And that is Airport from 1970, starring Dean Martin, Burt Lancaster, George Kennedy, Gene Seberg, and a cast of others. So sit back, obey the fasten the seatbelt signs. I'll get the contact details out of the way and we will start the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of classic movie appreciation. There are only two rules to the podcast. The first one is that I have to like the film, or it's been suggested by a Patreon subscriber. The other rule is that it has to be at least 20 years old. So none of this new stuff, it's all old, it's all good. So if you want to contact me, you can email at cultguru@gmail.com, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U. @gmail.com, or else you can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also go to paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. Now, there occasionally are adult themes and adult language used in this podcast. Just be aware of that as well. You can also leave reviews on iTunes, so if you're so inclined, please do so. It would help the podcast out a lot. So sit back, relax now, and we'll get on with the show. And thank you for listening. Hi, how's everybody doing? I'm recording this one back-to-back with the last Martian Drive-In podcast, so my energy levels flag. I do apologise, but I should be okay. If you don't listen to Martian Drive-In podcasts, I'll tell you what Sally and I have been doing lately. We went up to Sydney for 3 days, and then we went to Perth for 10 days. So we had 2 weeks in another couple of towns. It was a marvellous holiday for us. We saw a lot of things we hadn't seen before. We did some things we hadn't done before, including when we were in Perth shooting some pistols in a shooting range, which was fun. But if you go back and listen to the last Martian Drive-In podcast, I do go into a little bit about gun control and how I think it's a good idea. But having said that, shooting a 9mm Walther PPQ pistol at a target 10 metres away and doing pretty well with it was a lot of fun. I can see the attraction, and I can also see the danger of pistol shooting. Nonetheless, putting bullets into a clip and then slamming the clip into the bottom of the butt of the gun and then pressing down that lever that makes the slide shoot forward and then just blasting away at a target is something that brings back the child in me. I'll be honest about that. But nonetheless, we've been having a great time. Did see a couple of movies in Perth. We saw Jurassic World, which was a blast. It's a roller coaster of a movie. I like Chris Pratt in it. I like dinosaurs. Don't like the high heels so much, but you can't have everything. And we saw a 40th anniversary version of Jaws at a place called the Backlot, which is a small venue in West Perth. Travis Johnson, who does a Patreon blog, and he is asking for supporters, called Celluloid and Whiskey, ran it as his first event for Celluloid and Whiskey. The Backlot seats about 50 people, very, very comfortable seats. It's mostly done for movie previews and for corporate events and big screen computer gaming and things like that, but it's a nice venue. It's got a big mural of the guys from Reservoir Dogs on the wall. There were free cupcakes with shark fins on them, and we got to see Jaws on the big screen. A lot of people hadn't seen it, which it hadn't really struck me, because I saw it on the big screen when it first came out, because I've had that many birthdays. But a lot of people hadn't, and they really got a kick out of seeing Jaws on the big screen for the first time. Nice venue, nice people too. And if you go to Celluloid and Whiskey on the Patreon website, you can have a look at some of Travis's work and support him as a Patreon subscriber, should you choose to do so. He's good people and he's on the right side of things. But that was about it. We did have some nice weather. It's winter here, but nonetheless, the temperature was up around 20 degrees most days. Got rained on a little bit, but on the other hand, we had some great food, some great company. We had coffee with Alyssa from Galactic Suburbia podcast and her 19-month-old daughter, Mackenzie. So we hung around a cafe there for a couple of hours, shooting the shit and having a good time. Caught up with Mr. Robin Penn from Diabolic Records and Books, which is a fairly new bookshop in Perth. I've known Robin casually for a very long time, so it was nice to catch up and see his new venture there. If you ever get to Perth, go to Diabolic Records and Books, because it's got some fantastic books there. It's got some fantastic vinyl. I picked up some vinyl there, which I hadn't known existed. And, yeah, they're good people and they're well worth supporting. So, back from vacation tomorrow, I go back to work, which, of course, at being the end of vacation, you never look forward to, but it'll be nice to catch up with people again and get some fruitful endeavours done when I get back to work. And somewhat refreshed from it as well, even though the travel across the country's problematic. And that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this particular podcast. Air travel has been very much on my mind for the last few weeks. And so I thought I'd do a couple of disaster movies. Now, I did record an intro to this podcast while I was flying across Australia. Didn't quite work out the way I wanted to. There was way too much background noise for it to be at all viable, which is totally a shame, because I really would have liked to have done the intro while flying in a large aircraft, in a great big cigar tube in the sky. But it just wasn't to be. I'm really not happy enough with the audio to put it out there. But anyway, the movies for this time around are The High and the Mighty from 1955, a Bat Jack production, which was John Wayne's own production company, with a big ensemble cast, and it's set on a flight from Hawaii to San Francisco, and the aeroplane gets into some trouble, and there's some drama there, personal drama, mechanical problems, all that sort of thing. And it's a nice little character piece. I do like it. It's over the top and silly, but it's a nice little film to watch. And then we go to the kind of start of the disaster movie genre, in a sense, with 1970s Airport, starring Burt Lancaster, Dean Martin, George Kennedy, Gene Seberg, and a host of others as well. Helen Hayes is in it, and Maureen Stapleton's in it. A whole bunch of people are in there. And it started, there were three sequels to that, of course. There was Airport 75, Airport 77, and Airport 79, The Concorde, each of which was slightly worse than the one before. I have watched all four of them now in the last week, and I don't recommend more than maybe the first one. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to talk about them in chronological order. And the first film we're going to talk about is 1955's The High and the Mighty, John Wayne film, which doesn't necessarily have John Wayne on the screen all the time, which is kind of interesting.
One by one, they boarded the plane. The most bizarre group of people ever thrown together by fate on the most exciting adventure that ever spanned an ocean. There was Dan, who had used up his 9 lives and was starting on number 10. May, who could talk to a man without saying a word. Lydia, who was as low as high society can get. Sullivan, whose nerves of steel were beginning to rust. Sally, who lived in a world of whistles. Ed, who had taught himself to face disaster with a smile. Pardee, a heart full of courage wrapped up in a bundle of nerves. Childs, a wealthy collector of other men's wives. Flaherty, who thought he could hide his fears in a bottle. Agnew, a coward, until he held a gun in his hand. Spaulding, a right girl who had to be nice to some wrong people. Yes, the brash and the brave, big-timers and two-timers, the chaste and the cheats, morning glories and nighttime women, suddenly transformed by a single stroke of fate into people with all pretense gone and every violent emotion turned loose.
You're quite a conqueror with the ladies, aren't you? That should interest you, madam.
I've had enough of them.
What's the matter, you guys?
Hey, what's this
He's got a gun.
What?
The bottle on
it. Homie, pull the bottle quick.
Welby, check your final position. I'm going to take her down.
Wait a few more minutes.
Do as I say.
But it looks like...
Do as I say.
Give him a few more minutes.
I've already waited too long. Here we go.
No, we don't.
Get a hold of yourself, you yellow.
The High and the Mighty is a 1954 Hollywood film. I've been saying 1955, but it's actually 1954. It was directed by William A. Wellman. And I'll talk about Wellman a little bit before I go any further because he's an interesting guy. He was a World War I fighter ace with the Lafitte Escadrille, who were a French air corps during World War I. He went on to do a number of other things and ended up in the movie business and became a movie director. But the last movie he actually directed was a movie called Lafayette Escadrille, which was about his time as a pilot during World War I. In fact, Wellman did a number of aviation-related movies, including, of course, The High and the Mighty. You might remember a movie called Wings that won the first Academy Award. He directed that as well. He directed the Frederick March Janet Gaynor version of A Star Is Born and other movies like The Oxbow Incident, Public Enemy, Battleground, Ring of Fear, which is an interesting little film. If you ever get a 1950s movie called Ring of Fear, you should watch that one. And Buffalo Bill, Roxy Hart, Reaching for the Sun, Beau Geste, he did the sound version of Beau Geste, a Tarzan movie, uncredited. Robin Hood of El Dorado, got to see something like that. But yeah, so basically he had a long career. He was known as a man's man and a man's director. He didn't like the narcissism of male actors, but he liked them because he was a man. He was very impatient with female actors because it took so long to do hair and makeup and things like that, and he was an impatient kind of guy. Married 5 times, eventually found a happy marriage that lasted the rest of his life. But he was really, apparently he's a very handsome man. A lot of his leading ladies in the early years fell in love with him because he was a dashing man's man and quite handsome. But anyway, the movie stars, getting back to The High and the Mighty and getting off the Bill Wellman. He was known as Wild Bill Wellman. The movie stars John Wayne, Claire Trevor, Lorraine Day, Robert Stack as the pilot, Jan Sterling, Phil Harris, Robert Newton, who people might remember from a few films like Long John Silver and Odd Man Out, David Bryan, Paul Kelly, Sidney Blackmer, a character actor called John Howard, no relation to the benighted Australian Prime Minister, William Campbell, who people remember from the original series of Star Trek, and Doran, John Quaylen, Paul Fix, who was also in the original pilot, I think, of Star Trek, which is kind of interesting, and a bunch of other character actors. In fact, William Shallot's in there as well. He's probably the only person in the movie that's still alive. But, yeah, so basically the story is a plane takes off from Honolulu heading for San Francisco. It's a 12-hour trip. It's a DC-4. This is 1954. You have to go through passport control because Hawaii was not yet a state. And right at the start of the movie, you get a long sequence of all of the main characters being introduced at the passport control by their name, their age, and where they were born. So you get a little bit of background on them in an info dump at the front end of the movie where one of the airline employees is chatting to the stewardess, who is one of the more interesting characters in the movie from my point of view. She only ever gets her surname, which is really, really strange, because I would have liked to have known more about the character, but nope, just gets a surname, which is Spaulding, Miss Spaulding. That's all she's known as in the movie. She's played by an actress come model called Doe Avedon, who was married to Richard Avedon in the early days. If you've seen the movie Funny Face, the movie Funny Face is pretty much based on the life of Richard and Doe Avedon. And in this one, she's pretty good. She doesn't take shit from people. She's funny, compassionate, wry, worldly, and pretty much a very, very cool character. She's one of those characters that plays well to a 21st century audience because she's competent at her job. She handles people well, and she's got her own kind of dignity, which I kind of like there. For it's one of those roles that in the hands of a bad writer and perhaps a worse actor, it would have been handled differently. But she comes across very much as a Preston Sturges kind of female character who meets men on their own terms and matches them in her own way. And I like her for that. So anyway, the plane takes off and gets going. One of the engines conks out and the propeller rips off it because it's a four-engine plane. And they start losing fuel. And the problem comes up that they've got to find a way to get to the coast. You've got to remember this is before GPS, where locations were easy to find. This is before really, really fast fighter aircraft could find people quickly. And there were other means of rescuing people. And so the plane's limping along, heading towards the California coast. And there's an argument aboard the plane between the pilot, played by Robert Stack, and the co-pilot, Doran, played by John Wayne, who's an older character who survived a plane crash that killed his wife and child. And it's left him with a limp, and he's only co-pilot on the plane, so he doesn't actually have the authority of a pilot. But he has a lot more experience than the captain, played by Robert Stack. So the decision's got to be made at one stage whether they ditch or whether they try to limp along to the coast. And the movie's tension comes from that. It also comes from the characters. This movie is based on quite an old template from well over 20 years before. There was an Edmund Goulding movie in 1932 called Grand Hotel, which was the template for this kind of movie, where you get a whole bunch of people in one place, characters interact, there are tensions between them, and the events change their life. Now, Grand Hotel starred Greta Garbo, John Barrymore, Joan Crawford, Wallace Beery, Lionel Barrymore, and a bunch of other people, and was a very successful film. It's one of those movies that sets up the template for a whole bunch of other movies, a whole bunch of people in one place at one time, and they interact and their lives are changed by it. Now, this is just, in a sense, Grand Hotel in the sky, which a lot of these kind of airplane disaster movies tend to be. You get that kind of thing, and it can be argued that Airport, the other movie I'm going to talk about today, is pretty much the same thing in a sense. But the characters in the film are kind of ramped up, and the tensions are ramped up. You've got a whole bunch of different characters. You've got Claire Trevor playing a very fine character actor who's in one of my favourite films. She plays the shrewish wife, which is hard to say, of Edward G. Robinson's character, Kruger, in 2 Weeks in Another Town. This is a number of years later. She plays Mae Holster, kind of good time girl, an ageing good time girl, who's on the plane. Lorraine Day plays a millionaireist, Lydia Rice, whose husband's played by John Howard and has invested some of their money in a dubious mining venture, which she's pissed off about. You got Robert Stack as Sullivan, the captain. Jan Sterling as Sally McKee. Now, Jan Sterling is a fantastic actor who got an Academy Award nomination for this film, in fact, and who you might remember was the blonde wife of Leo in Ace in the Hole. She's in this one playing an aging beauty who's gone off to marry a man she's only corresponded with, and she's kind of fudged her age a little bit, and she's worried about meeting the man she's going to marry when she arrives in San Francisco. So she's got her own thing there. You got Robert Newton playing Gustav Pardee, who's a theatrical producer who's kind of selfish and childish, but really comes good during the course of the film. He finds his own courage. He finds his own wisdom during the film, which is really nice. You got character actor David Bryan playing Ken Charles, who's a wealthy man, a bit of a playboy in his 50s, who causes a certain tension on the plane, which I won't spoil. And then you've got an aging actor called Paul Kelly, no relation to the Australian singer, playing a scientist called Flaherty, who's been working on nuclear testing in the Pacific atolls and has had a breakdown and decided that he doesn't want to do that anymore. He doesn't want his work to lead to the end of the world. So you get him aboard the plane, and he's become an alcoholic because of it. Those tensions have caused him to be an alcoholic. And you got a couple of older people. You got Paul Fix in there as Frank Briscoe, who's an older man who's dying of cancer and has a nice rapport with the stewardess. You got John Quaylen, who appeared in any number of John Ford westerns as Scandinavian older characters, playing a fisherman in this movie. And there are a number of other people, including an actor called Joy Kim playing Dorothy Chen, an Asian lady travelling to San Francisco, and she's got to be the most clichéd and caricatured Asian female character I've seen in movies in a while. If there's anything to dissuade people from watching this movie, it's probably this character. It's really handled badly and doesn't do any justice to the rest of the film, which is a shame because the rest of the film is quite interesting and there's some really nice bits of acting in it as well. John Wayne's character is very much a secondary character in the movie, which is interesting given that his production company produced the film. He'd done a previous film based on a novel by the man who wrote the novel The High and the Mighty, Ernest K. Gann, a movie called Island in the Sky about a plane that crashes in the Canadian wilderness and the people aboard have to survive in some very cold conditions. So he got the rights to this movie. Originally, he wanted Spencer Tracy to star as Dan Roman, the character that he plays in the movie, but for some reason Tracy and he couldn't get along to seeing him play the role, which is a shame because I could really see Tracy doing the role and doing it justice as well, but for whatever reason he didn't do so. He was starting to be unwell at that stage, so it may have been a health issue that caused him not to do it. But he's kind of an older pilot. He's apparently used up all his luck surviving the plane crash that killed his family. And he's kind of quiet and somber, and he's got a little bit of PTSD, as a couple of scenes slightly allude to in there. But he's been flying planes for longer than the pilot, played by Robert Stack, has been alive. So he's got a wealth of experience there, which comes to the fore. Now, Robert Stack, of course, if you remember him from movies like Airplane, of course, The High and the Mighty is one of the reasons why Robert Stack's in the movie Airplane, also known as Flying High, and you get that kind of stiff, stilted dialogue kind of thing. Robert Stack was always like that. He was in a movie. He was in a musical called A Date with Judy, and he was as stiff as a board in that as well. The longevity of his career is one of the great mysteries of Hollywood, in a sense, because he really didn't have much range as an actor. He could only play things one way, and in this movie, he does a meltdown. But it's not a particularly great piece of acting. Gets slapped around by John Wayne a little bit and then gets his shit together and flies a plane. But, the weird thing is that there's not really a focal character in the plane. Yes, you've got John Wayne there almost as a frame around the movie where at the start of the film, a third party on the landing field tells the story of his character. There's a lot of front-loading on the character stuff in this movie, which is a little bit kludgy from the 21st century screenwriting point of view, but nonetheless, it tells you who everybody is and what their relationships are right off the bat, so you can settle down, relax, get on the plane with them, and just see what happens during the course of events. But it's interesting seeing John Wayne in a John Wayne movie now. I got this one for $5 at a kind of $2 shop kind of store, you know, one of those cheap stores that sell everything from paper clips to armchairs kind of thing. I got this one for $5 in Perth. And it's part of it says here of the military collection. The John Wayne Military Collection, which is not because basically the movie is about civilian pilots, not about pilots in the military. So who knows? It's misleading. It's a double set one too. I've really got to check out some of the documentary stuff about this movie as well. But it's filmed in CinemaScope too, so you've got that eye-popping 1950s Technicolor happening there. And CinemaScope, which Wellman uses very well to kind of show the isolation of the plane. There's some really nice aerial photography in this one, showing the plane flying through clouds. You've got to remember that planes in those days didn't fly anywhere near as high as planes do now. Nobody's going to pass out and have oxygen masks drop down in this plane. It's only a DC-4. And it's really interesting from a technical viewpoint. The instruments on the on the dashboard are kind of rudimentary. There's a scene where a couple of the characters go down to the back of the plane to see if there's any damage, and there are a whole bunch of cables and pulleys running from the back of the plane where the flaps are to the front of the plane, and they're all just basically that, just that, exposed pulleys and cables moving slightly backwards and forwards on great big reels, which is kind of as the plane is, but it looks really weird from our point of view with fly-by-wire technology. But yeah, and there's a scene too where they've got to lighten the load. So something John Wayne does is he has to force the door open against the airflow while they drop luggage and things out of the plane, which you can do on a DC-4, but you couldn't really do on a 747. So it's kind of almost a diesel punk sort of story in a way, because it's got all of these obsolete technologies which really make it a slightly unusual movie from our viewpoint, from our known experience of flying in aeroplanes. I mean, I remember the first plane I flew in was a Cessna, four-seater Cessna, and it wasn't much bigger than a car. And I remember the first time I flew in a large aeroplane, an aeroplane you could stand up in, and it was a total shock to me then. But this kind of movie is from that point of view in a sense, because it's a time when air travel wasn't very common, and particularly air travel across half of the Pacific Ocean was a non-trivial thing to do at that stage, and it was with potential risks as well. A 12-hour flight, you had to calculate very carefully the fuel and the weight of the plane at the time, and they do show some bits at the start where they do those calculations. And ongoing, as the plane starts leaking fuel, the navigator has to do those calculations, and the navigator is a kind of minor character in the film as well, and he's, you know, not really well written, if you know what I mean, which is a little bit of a shame. But the bigger name actors get all of the real drama in this film. Jan Sterling is really, really good in her role, and I think deservedly got the Academy Award nomination, because there's a kind of type of well-worn woman that Jan Sterling played really well in movies. And there's a scene where she takes off all her makeup, which is something you never saw in 1950s films of women doing. And she gets out the cold cream and takes off all her makeup when she's talking to one of the other characters, which is kind of a bold thing for any actress in the 1950s to do, because it was all about the artifice, it was all about the war paint and not about the face underneath. But she breaks through that and gets some credit for doing that as well from our viewpoint as well. There's all that stuff on social media now of actresses having their photo taken without makeup on. Like, it's a big, bold, brave thing to do, whereas Jan Sterling did it 60 years ago. And there are also some kind of light comic relief characters. Phil Harris and his wife in the movie, played by Ann Doran, are a couple of kind of working stiffs who save up a lot of money to go take this Hawaii holiday. And there's a little bit of a comic backstory on that and how disastrous their holiday had turned out. And that Phil Harris was a band leader. If you don't know Phil Harris, he played the voice of Baloo the bear in The Jungle Book, the Disney version of The Jungle Book, amongst other things. So he was a band leader and actor and radio star too. He did a lot of sitcom radio in the 1940s. In fact, he was one of the pioneers of sitcoms as a format, which was originally done on radio in the 1940s. And he plays it very broadly. I don't think he was very gifted as an actor. But that's kind of contrasted with Robert Newton, who was an actor who had an alcohol problem his whole life and his whole career and died early because of it. And in this one, playing Party, the theatrical producer, he starts out as a selfish, vain, almost childish character, but there's a part where he has to interact with other characters, and he's got a nice arc there. He finds his own courage and finds his own wisdom in doing that, and Robert Newton puts that across really, really well. It's not particularly an overwritten part, but Robert Newton kind of fills the gaps wonderfully in that movie. And there is some really nice acting in this film. You're not going to particularly get it from John Wayne because he just plays John Wayne in whatever movie he's in. There's rarely a role that's anything but John Wayne in a John Wayne filmography. But the character actors around him really do fill that gap, those gaps nicely, and I kind of like that. Again, as it is a kind of portmanteau, it's not a portmanteau film, it's a group thing, it's an ensemble film. It's all about the different characters and the way they interact and the way actors kind of play against each other and play off each other to get a really nice feel for the drama in there. And this is quite dramatic too. There are parts where, I mean, I knew the ending of the film before I saw it this time, but I still have that doubt about, are they going to do this or are they not going to do this? And there are arguments either way. And it's just a matter of, it comes down to the experience of Dan Roman, the character played by John Wayne, which is the deciding factor. Yes, they've got calculations based on fuel consumption and the fuel and the tailwinds and all that kind of thing, but ultimately there's a judgment call to be made there. And it's experience that lets them make the judgment call. And I kind of like that. I like those uncertainties and the fact that you can't nail everything down with a calculation. There's a point at which you've got to make a decision based on gut feeling. And the gut feeling, of course, prevails in this instance. There are times, of course, when gut feeling doesn't prevail. But in this instance, it prevails. And it's a nice kind of 1950s movie in that sense. It's not particularly deep, but it does give, and this is nice too, it gives female actors a chance to shine as much as male actors. And not just in cliched roles either. There are a couple of cliched female roles in there, but in general, the women are given as much oxygen as the men. And that's a funny thing to say in a movie set on an aeroplane, but nonetheless, that's what it comes down to. It's an honest movie, and it does do justice to both men and women in the film. And for that, I kind of like it. There are movies I've seen which don't do that. And there are movies that make you cringe because of sexual politics in it. But in this one, with the exception of the Ann Doran character playing Phil Harris's wife, who ends up having a breakdown and screaming and being a kind of nervous wreck about it. I suppose somebody has to in this kind of movie, but it kind of didn't play particularly well for me to have her just kind of do that and just fall apart. I think that it just didn't play well for some reason. And take a look at the movie and let me know what you think about that, whether it's valid or not, because I found that one character, apart from the Asian woman, Dorothy Chen, in the movie, they were the two roles that really pissed me off in a sense. But anyway, The High and the Mighty, it's very much of its time. Ernest K. Gann also wrote the screenplays to a couple of other movies, one of which was Soldier of Fortune, which is a Clark Gable movie from the mid-1950s, which I know Dr. Zom is very, very fond of. He really loves that movie and likes a lot of the characters in it as well, and he recommended it to me, and I watched it a few years ago. It's a kind of standard adventure film from the time. No better than it has to be, but it does have the grandeur of CinemaScope. It's got the colour photography. It's got some honest bits of screenwriting which kind of work well and other bits that don't work well. But it does have a whole bunch of character actors in there that do a pretty good job of things in general. It was well worth the $5 I paid for the 2-disc DVD edition of this. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When we get back, we're going to talk about the blockbuster to end all blockbusters, Airport from 1970, which has a great cast. And in some ways, the special effects are slightly worse than they were in The High and the Mighty, which was 16 years before.
Airport, the year's most widely read novel, becomes today's most exciting, most timely motion picture. Airport, big scale in every way, has the biggest all-star cast ever assembled for a single Universal motion picture. Burt Lancaster, Dean Martin, Gene Seberg, Jacqueline Bisset, George Kennedy, Helen Hayes, Van Heflin, Maureen Stapleton, Barry Nelson, Lloyd Nolan, Donna Winter.
pilot from your Flight 45 made a shortcut across the field, and he didn't make it.
Well, what are you doing about it?
Well, when the snow melts in April, we'll get it out.
What the hell do you think I'm doing about it?
Outselling any novel of recent years, translated into 14 languages, Arthur Haley's Airport was written for the screen and directed by Academy Award winner George Seaton. It has seven stories tied into one. Dean Martin is pilot Vernon Demarest, loved by stewardess Jacqueline Bissett, and by his wife, Barbara Hale.
You're sure?
Do you mean am I sure I'm pregnant? Or am I sure you're the father?
Burt Lancaster is airport manager Mel Bakersfeld, at the crisis stage with his socialite wife, Donna Winter.
A week ago, I didn't know we'd have the worst storm in 6 years.
You've always got some damn excuse.
Gene Seberg is Tanya, his devoted assistant.
I'll miss you.
Will you? Enough not to let me go.
The first lady of the American stage, Helen Hayes, plays the mind-boggling, huggable, perpetual stowaway, Ada Quonset.
Oh, my dear, I couldn't possibly afford a ticket.
Van Heflin gives a superb performance as the desperate Guerrero, matched by Maureen Stapleton as his wife.
Stop dreaming. Just hold on to the job.
I'll do it right this time. I won't mess it up.
And lusty, gutsy Petroni has to be Academy Award winner George Kennedy.
I'll have this mother out of here by midnight.
Is there any chance that the plane would stand the explosion?
Oh, she might still fly. But the sudden decompression at 30,000 feet is something you gotta see to believe.
Now sit down and be quiet.
Oh, you hurt me. You hurt me.
Stop it. You're hysterical.
Oh, help me. Please help me. Help me.
No.
Property, you've got no right to take it over here.
Stop! Stop!
No! No!
No! You stay where you are!
Guerrero, listen to me. You'll kill yourself or nothing if you explode that bomb.
For crisis authenticity, Airport has no equal. For mounting tension, Airport has no equal.
Decompression making emergency descent.
For sheer fingernail-biting suspense, Airport has no equal.
You are leaving my area. Contact Cleveland Center, 117.5. Good luck.
Airport.
We're gonna crash. We're gonna be killed. I know we're all gonna be...
Airport was a crazily successful movie from a financial point of view. It cost $10 million to make, and it made over $100 million. Now, if you want to put that in 2015 money, you're talking a movie that was up there with things like Jurassic World and the second Avengers movie. In its own terms, it was that successful. Crazily good. It had very popular stars, and it had Dean Martin, had Burt Lancaster, had Gene Seberg, who was at the time having trouble with the CIA because of association with the Black Panther movement. It had character actors that people really did like George Kennedy, who a few years before had won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Cool Hand Luke, and Van Heflin, who this was his last theatrical movie. He did a couple of TV movies afterwards, but he in the 1940s had also won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar. They stacked the cast with well-known people. Maureen Stapleton's in it as well. Barbara Hale, who people knew from Perry Mason on television. Just really familiar faces all across the movie. Helen Hayes, who was very popular as a theatrical actress, is in there playing a character called Ada Quonset, who's an old lady who has worked out a way to basically social engineer the airline industry so that she can hitchhike across the country whenever she wants to visit her family. And that's pretty much the way she does it, the standard way that hackers do social engineering. This little old lady in a 1970 movie does exactly the same approach to sneaking onto airplanes, which is very, very cool. The story is a big one. Basically, Burt Lancaster's character, Mel, runs the Chicago airport. They're getting a once-in-a-10-year storm. There's snow all over the place. An airplane has just run off the runway, so it's blocking one of the runways with its tail. And he's got to try to run everything on a very busy holiday weekend. Dean Martin plays his brother-in-law, who's one of the airline pilots. He's married to Mel Blankensfeld's sister, played by Barbara Hale. And at the same time, he's having an affair with one of the stewardesses, played by Jacqueline Bisset. And one can hardly blame him. And this is another one of those movies from the time that has a great age discrepancy between romantic interests in it, because Dean Martin was twice the age of Jacqueline Bisset at the time the movie was made. So she's also letting him know that she's pregnant. So basically, he's married, his girlfriend's pregnant, and she's also one of the stewardesses on the flight. You've got George Kennedy playing Petroni. He was in all four of the airport movies. He's the only character in all four of them, who's basically an engineer who knows the 707 airplane inside out. He chomps on cigars and wears a hat and calls things mothers and all that kind of stuff. So he's the tough guy, working class hero kind of character in the movie. You've got a whole bunch of passengers. You've got doctors on there. You've got a priest. You've got Ada Quonset, who snuck onto the plane. You've got a number of other characters there. And you've got a character called D.O. Guerrero. And I knew I'd get that wrong. Played by Van Heflin, who is on the plane with a bomb because he's bought insurance to help his wife. They're doing very badly financially. And he wants to provide for his wife, and the only way he sees of doing that is to blow up the plane and claim the insurance that he's put on himself at the airport for the flight. So again, it's a little bit like the High and the Mighty, but it's scaled up. It's a much bigger airplane, much more complicated airplane. There's a lot more to do with the people on the ground trying to get things done and to help the plane. Communications between the ground and the plane are a lot better than they were in 1954 when the High and the Mighty is made. And so they do kind of communicate with the tower and with the ground crew a lot more efficiently than they do in the High and the Mighty. But again, a lot of it's to do with the lives of the characters. Mel has trouble with his wife, played by Dana Winter, and a very miscast as the wife of an airport operator. She feels neglected by him and eventually tells him that she's leaving him. And in the meantime, he's kind of having a thing with his assistant, played by Gene Seberg. This was in the days before fraternization at work was frowned on, obviously. So there are all these kind of soap opera-ish currents running through things. But overall, it's a very entertaining movie. It is a kind of grand hotel on an aeroplane. And Judith Crist, one of the critics at the time, said of this movie, Airport 1970, that it was the best movie made in 1944 because it's very old school. It's a very old school story. It is Grand Hotel, and the people who were reviewing it at the time were well aware of that. But it was based on a novel by Arthur Haley, who wrote a number of other kind of what we now call airport novels, in the sense that they're the kind of books you used to pick up at airport newsstands and read on flights and things like that. Those great big thick chunky novels. And Airport was a very popular one. He also wrote the book on which another movie I've talked about in Paleo Cinema podcast was based, and that was Hotel, the one with Rod Taylor and Carmen McRae and Michael Rennie in it. I talked about that in a previous podcast. He wrote that. So he wrote those kind of, you know, contained soap opera stories with a sense of menace about them. In this case, the menace, of course, is the fact that a mentally disturbed character played by Van Heflin has a bomb on board the plane. Now, I want to talk about that for a little bit, because his wife in the movie is played by Maureen Stapleton, who got an Oscar nomination for her role in this film, as indeed did Helen Hayes, playing the old lady who hitchhikes onto airplanes. But there's some interesting scenes between Van Heflin and Maureen Stapleton, and with them individually, which I found kind of quite surprising in some ways, because it deals with mental illness. his character had a mental breakdown after being an army demolition expert and obviously suffering from something like PTSD. PTSD comes up a lot in this podcast for some reason. And he has problems with authority. So he would get a job doing construction work and get pissed off at the boss and lose the job and that kind of thing. So he hasn't been able to get work. His wife's working a couple of shifts in a diner so they can make ends meet. They have debts. They're very, very hard done by financially. And that's why Guerrero decides to do this stupid thing with the insurance on the aeroplane. The plane's going to Italy. He decides he's going to blow it up once it's over the ocean, so they can't really do much retrieval on it. They don't have the retrieval technologies for aeroplane crashes that we do now. And so he would get away with it, and his wife would get $225,000 on the insurance claim. Now, looking at movies of the time and before 1970, mental illness wasn't treated sympathetically in a lot of cases. Yes, there were some movies that were exceptions to that, but this kind of thing where a guy gets a bomb and he's going to blow up a plane so his wife could get an insurance claim in spite of the fact that it will kill a number of other people as well. In a normal Hollywood film, that wouldn't have been treated sympathetically, but the character is not treated unsympathetically in this movie, and I really admire the film for that. He's pretty much put this down to a couple of things. Maureen Stapleton and Van Heflin. I think that he decides to... there's a review of this movie by Roger Ebert where he says that the only people who are in on the joke of this movie are Van Heflin and Maureen Stapleton. They decide to act the guts out of it rather than just playing the role, in a sense. And I kind of agree with that because Van Heflin's character is a man in enormous pain, and he's scared, he's in pain, he can't provide for his wife. And he, you know, he portrays that very well. Heflin was a very fine actor. I remember him in movies like Shane, for instance, where he plays the kind of thankless role of the kid's father when Shane comes to the farm. And in 3:10 to Yuma, a really fine character actor who portrayed mental anguish very well and portrayed complicated decision-making really well in an acting role. And I really like Van Heflin for that. I think that even when he played unsympathetic characters, which he sometimes did, he was a lot of fun. He also played one of the Three Musketeers in the 1945 version of the Three Musketeers, which had Gene Kelly in it, and he was fantastic in that as well. A totally different kind of role from this one, but a really interesting one nonetheless. So we've got Guerrero in there, and he and his problems and the mental anguish that causes for his wife, Inez, played by Maureen Stapleton, is portrayed really well in this movie, and it's totally at a totally different level of acting, at a totally different level of realism than most of the rest of the film, where you've got the kind of cute old lady who keeps hacking her way, in the sense of hacking, you know, social engineering, hacking your way onto aeroplane trips and bamboozling great big airlines. You've got that, which plays very much lighter. You've got the kind of soap opera-ish problems of the airline pilot, played by Dean Martin, with his girlfriend being pregnant, played by Jacqueline Bisset. You've got the other problems, the family problems between Dana Winter's character and Burt Lancaster's character. And they're at a totally different level than the problems of the man who's the trigger for the disaster. Now, it's not a giveaway because it's in the trailer that Guerrero, and I have trouble with that name for some reason, runs into the toilet on the aeroplane and blows up the bomb, blowing a hole in the side of the plane and injuring the stewardess played by Jacqueline Bisset. Now the problem arises, of course, of clearing the runway so the plane can land. Will the plane tear itself apart in midair? Because there are a lot of structural problems with it after the bomb blows out the toilet and the side of the plane. And can Dean Martin land the plane? So you've got all those kind of things, which are the melodrama aspects of the movie as well. But and they're played realistically. There's a lot of business to do with how an airport runs and how an airline is run and how aeroplanes are run and the special qualities of the aeroplane. What happens when there's explosive decompression on an aeroplane? George Kennedy gets a nice little speech about that in the movie as well. And how do you get an aeroplane which is bogged in snow and mud off a runway? They go into some details about that as well. So there's all those kind of hidden knowledge details that keep it interesting for the tech wogs. You've got the human drama and the kind of soap opera drama, which keeps 1970s female viewers happy. You get the real drama of the bomber and his wife, which keeps people who like good acting happy. And you get a lot of stuff shot on location at an airport, which keeps history buffs happy. Because you've got to remember, 1970 now is 45 years ago. And that, everything you see on the screen is a kind of historical artifact in a sense. And that makes it even more interesting. The fact that people could smoke on aeroplanes, for instance. The fact that people smoked pretty much anywhere at the time makes for kind of a bit of dissonance there. The fact there was no real luggage scanning in the way that we know it now, which enabled somebody to get a bomb onto an aeroplane in an attaché case, is interesting for us with our hyper-vigilant security at airports. And I was thinking about this movie while I was thinking back on the security scans I had to go through at the airport. Sally had a deodorant can that was a bit too big on her carry-on luggage, and that was queried by the people at the security desks. And the fact that you've got to take your phone and your wallet out and stick them through the scanners, all that kind of stuff. And the movie does give you a sense, the same sense that I had traveling through various airports over the last few weeks, of airports being a great big machine run by a number of people. And the machine's job is to get people in, get them into the air, bring them down from the air, get them out again. It's a kind of delivery system for human beings in a sense. And there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes that we rarely see. What are all those people down on the tarmac doing when you look out of the window of the aeroplane before it takes off? You know, we don't necessarily know what they're all doing, but we know that they're all part of that big machine that's only job is to basically take people down out of the sky and put people back up in the sky and then get them out on their way. Now, both Dean Martin and Burt Lancaster dismiss this movie as a piece of rubbish, even though both of them made an immense amount of money and profit participation on the film. But even if it is, it's very slick rubbish. It's very well made. It's tailored. It's kind of like an airport in a way. It has a job of entertaining people in a dark room for a certain period of time. And it does do that. It's got some interesting actors in it. It has a lot of tension in it. It's got various kinds of acting in it as well. It's got the relaxed kind of acting you get from a character like Dean Martin, who makes everything look effortlessly easy when he does it, even though there is an art to it. You've got the kind of intense, kind of gritted teeth acting of somebody like Burt Lancaster. Then you've got the kind of working class tough guy acting of George Kennedy, who, by the way, is still alive. He's in his 90s and he hasn't acted for a while, but he is still alive. And having said that, I'll probably use the Paleo Cinema curse to kill George Kennedy right now. But and then you've got the kind of more delicate acting of someone like Dana Winter in there. You've got Gene Seberg, who's very plausible. You've got Jacqueline Bisset, who does have a couple of good scenes in the movie as well. And then you've got the more experienced older actors like Maureen Stapleton, who is in agony. Her character is in agony for most of the film. And you've got the effortless playfulness and kind of pixie-ish charm that comes from Helen Hayes' Ada Quonset. Just as a kind of display of different kinds of acting, this movie is very interesting from that point of view. Now, as I said, there were three sequels to this movie. Airport 75, which is the one with Charlton Heston and Karen Black in it, which is ridiculous. Airport 77, which is those people like Darren McGavin in it. Christopher Lee's in that one. You've got Jack Lemmon playing the hero, which is kind of interesting. And you've got James Stewart and a bunch of other character actors in it as well. Joseph Cotton's in it, for instance, and a bunch of other people as well, which is really kind of interesting. That one kind of plays a little bit better because the boat sinks in the Bermuda Triangle and they've got to try to get out and let people know where they are. Then you've got Airport 79, which is the one with the Concorde, and it's got Alain Delon in it. It's got George Kennedy in a much more prominent role. It's the only movie in the series where George Kennedy's character gets laid. He gets Cordis Interruptus with his wife in the first one, but for the rest of the, he doesn't get laid until the fourth movie with Bibi Anderson, which is kind of strange. But that one had a really weird cast too. People like Sylvia Christel playing the stewardess who's in love with Alain Delon, and Avery Schreiber and Charo and people like that in the movie. It really is an unusual little piece of work. And that one, they actually land the Concorde on a snowfield in the Alps, and it gets buried under snow in the snowfield as it pancakes in. So that one's probably the least of the series, but I watched all four of them. I binge-watched them earlier this weekend, yesterday. And the second one's just bug-fuck crazy. The third one's kind of interesting because it's got some actors in it I like. And the fourth one's just not worth your effort, really, at all. I'll really, really bother with the fourth one. But, I mean, it did spawn the series, but like, kind of like the 1960s, 1970s Planet of the Apes series, the studio had an immensely popular film done on a reasonable budget, $10 million. And then when they did the sequels, the budgets were less, and the running time and the production values were less as well. And then they wondered why they couldn't make a profit out of them. It's kind of, now we know that if you're going to make a sequel, the sequel's got to be better than the one before, otherwise it's not really worth making. But in those days, they seemed to have a different viewpoint on sequels. They just wanted to milk the cash cow with minimum expenditure, rather than finding out what really worked on the first one and then putting more of that in there. They didn't kind of operate on that paradigm in earlier years. But nonetheless, I watched Airport and I found it interesting. It's got some nice technology in it. There's a scene where they've got some kind of tractor thing they drag across the tarmac, which have downward-pointing flamethrowers on them to melt the ice off the tarmac. And that kind of stuff was very cool because they actually did that. They burned fossil fuels like crazy in the 1970s. And you can very much see that evident in this movie. They've got very early CRT computers, which were only ever used in airports, which they show on the movie. And all these little bits of detail that you see, the women's dress designs, which were by Edith Head, were very cool and interesting as well. And the kind of sexual politics between men and women, where a certain level of infidelity was accepted as long as the person came home at the end of the day. Culturally, this movie, because it is in the 1970s and because it is a Hollywood film, is very much different than it would be now. And the empowerment of women is significantly less in the film as well. But it does have some virtues. It has some interesting acting in it. It does have that approach to the problems of the Guerreros. And it does show you some stars and some fine actors at various stages of their career, which makes it interesting from that kind of paleo cinema viewpoint, where we like to see people in early roles, we like to see people in late roles in their careers and see what they do with it, and just watch the artistry that some people bring to the job of acting, which is kind of cool. Now, I'm going to leave it there with Airport. I recommend you see the first one. Whether you see the second, third, or fourth one is entirely up to you. You will get a diminishing return by doing that. I'll just warn you up front that will happen. But nonetheless, I did enjoy it, and I did enjoy watching The High and the Mighty as well. Both of them are widescreen, kind of top-end Hollywood products. And both of them, the planes don't crash. Yeah. Now, you probably, if you're going to put a third movie on this, you probably try chuck in Die Hard 2. Because I just watched the end of Die Hard 2 by accident on television earlier today. I thought, geez, that would have gone on well with these movies because it's all about aeroplanes and airports and disasters and things. So the third movie in the triple feature would be Die Hard 2 if I was doing that. But anyway, I'm going to leave it there. I do have some feedback, but I'm going to save it till next time because I am on a bit of a rush catching up on podcasts at the moment. I do apologize for that. I did get some nice feedback, and I promise it will be in the next Paleo Cinema podcast. But anyway, I'm going to leave you, of course, now with the credits. As I said, there are a couple of credits I haven't put onto the credits yet, and I will do so before the next podcast. So in the meantime, everybody, look after yourselves. Keep watching good films. Be kind to each other. And I am very, very happy for America that marriage is now something that everybody can be a part of, as long as there's another consenting adult to do it with. So congratulations, guys. We hope to see you there very soon. But in the meantime, look after yourselves, and I'll be back really soon with more podcasting. And here are the podcast credits in the style of movie credits. And the way to get on the credits is to donate to the podcast via patreon.com/paleocinema. Okay, we have Tim the Mystery Credit. I haven't got the credit from Tim yet. We have Tammy the Donut Wrangler. Paul, the Special Makeup Effects Director. Mark, the Second Unit Director. Alyssa, the Location Scout. Tansy, the Foley Artist. Miss Jane, the Wardrobe Mistress. Christopher, the Gaffer. Chris, the Camera Operator. And we'll wait for the big crescendo in the music, which is Alberato del Gracioso by Ravel. Julia, the casting director. Elaine, the scientific advisor. Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler. Armin, the key grip. Jan, the dialect coach. Morris, the music director. Gary, the prop master. Claire, the script doctor. Grant, the technicolor consultant. Ian, the caterer. Sarah, the special effects technician. And Tom, the focus puller. Thank you very much to all of the people who support the podcast via the Patreon campaign. I'll catch you guys later.